From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. This half hour, I'll talk with University of Oklahoma historian Alan Levinson. He's a scholar of Jewish history and says the story of Jews in Germany during the 19th century is actually a success story.
Most German Jews in 1800 were beggars or peddlers, and by the year 1900, all of that was completely different.
We'll also talk about his latest work, studying the Bible. He says there's more common ground than you might expect between an historical reading and what he calls a devotional approach.
Some of the premises or axioms are contradictory, but if you put them into practice, you'll actually find that they're very mutually enriching.
We'll also hear about parallels to the current refugee crisis, right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. My guest today is Alan Levinson. He's a professor of Judaic history at the University of Oklahoma and is the author of several books examining Jewish history from biblical times to the present day. We'll talk about his work examining Jewish history in Germany between unification in 1871 and the start of the Nazi era in 1933, as well as ideas about ethnic memory and different interpretations of the Bible. Alan Levinson, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Alan, you're an expert on 19th century German Jewish history, and so I have to ask just right off the bat, kind of what drew you to that subject? What is it about 19th century German Jewish history that is of interest and importance?
Well, if you're in Jewish history, a lot of the main developments in, say, the study of Jewish history, a lot of what's considered part of modern Jewish culture, religious denominations, all of that stems from the 19th century and from German Jewry. And I also, pretty early on, was reacting against the idea of all of Jewish history being treated as an extension of the Holocaust. I found that to be unfortunate and unrepresentative. And so I was drawn toward a more creative and a more positive era.
So the contemporary thinking then, if I understand you correctly, is that everybody focuses on the Holocaust and 20th century Jewish experience, where you thought that there needed to be a better understanding or at least some attention being paid to, Jewish history goes back a long way. And, you know, if you've ever visited a Jewish museum, for example, you know that it goes back a long way. There's much more to it than what happened in the 20th century. So this is what you're saying, is that you just wanted to focus on those previous experiences.
That's absolutely true. And my teenage son will complain that he has visited every Jewish museum in every place that we've ever been to.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Holocaust and the Nazi era as this sort of vacuum that sucks everything up is also true in German history. If you were to go to our local Barnes & Nobles in Norman, you would see the number of books on the Nazi era is a whole shelf, and the number of books on anything else that happened in German history is, four or five books total. So it's more than just Jewish history, as I came to realize that.
So what are the main distinctions then? I mean, so because many of us are familiar with the Holocaust and what happened during the 20th century. So what are some of the main issues, or how would you characterize German Jewish history prior to that time period?
Well, the history of German Jewry in the 19th century, although it's so hard to believe now, was mainly a success story. It's a story of getting political equality, which took a couple of generations, at least, depending on the German state. It's a story about educational advance from a pretty parochial and Jewish-only subject matter to Jews being fully part of German educational and cultural life and contributing greatly. It's a story of economic, not necessarily rags to riches, but certainly a passage from overall impoverishment to very respectable middle class life. Most German Jews in 1800 were beggars or peddlers and had no rights of residence and spoke Yiddish, but were not part of the German national fabric. And by the year 1900, all of that was completely different. So I think it was a century, I still think it's a century in which Jewish life modernized in a most dramatic and believe it or not, generally positive way.
So it's interesting, though, that the 19th century is kind of like, as I'm hearing you saying, it's a success story. It's kind of a, you know, a bright light in Jewish history, quite in contrast to centuries before. And then, of course, in stark contrast to their experience of the 20th century. So what can you tell us, like, what are some of the underlying, you know, reasons for that? And is there any, are there any lessons that can or should be drawn from that period in terms of explaining today, 21st century Jewish experience?
Well, first of all, if you grew up, as I did, in the 60s and 70s, and then were trained in the 80s, you were told, and I think it's true, that you can't give in to a view of Jewish history that it was always about expulsion, martyrdom, and oppression. In fact, it wasn't, and there were many eras. We don't have enough time to go into all the eras, but in many, many times and places, Jewish life really flourished. And that is, I guess, because I'm an optimistic person, that always drew me more. In terms of looking into the 20th century, I wrote a book called Between Philo-Semitism and Anti-Semitism, in which I tried to show that at least until the Nazi takeover, there were many people in German society who were able to free themselves of anti-Jewish prejudice and had relatively positive views of either Jews or Judaism as the religion or Jewishness as a cultural thing, and that this was a real factor also, although a neglected one. So that was, you know, that was the subject of a whole book. And my positive takeaway is that such attitudes not only can exist, but generally do exist and deserve to be cultivated.
So interestingly, Alan, as I'm listening to you talk about the Jewish experience in the 19th century and, of course, what, you know, they experienced before and after, clearly having some negative, very negative experiences. I appreciate the fact you're focused on the kind of positive experience of the 19th century. But I can't help but think about some parallels with, you know, today's experience with Islamophobia, for example, with other segments of society. So not Jewish segments of society now, but Islamic segments of society around the world that are experiencing perhaps some similar problems and concerns and hatred, repression, expulsion. You know, we're dealing with all these migration issues now and immigrants, you know, coming and being welcome or not, you know, because of that. I think this is very similar, right, to the Jewish experience where they migrated around the world and were in flux and in some places were perhaps welcomed and in many places they weren't. I mean, could you perhaps draw some parallels are there any lessons perhaps we can use in terms of getting through this interesting time period for another segment of the world's society?
Well, I really have to say I'm hardly an expert in the modern Middle East, and that would be the right person to give you the best answer. But first of all, there's the humanitarian element, which I hope would be cut across everything. I mean, there's a terrible, terrible situation that everybody is aware of who reads the newspaper going on in Syria and in Iraq, and you have millions of refugees who need aid and need assistance, and where to best provide that assistance and how to best provide it is really not something that I have much knowledge as to what would be the best way to handle it. I think what is clear is the idea of trying to impose a religious test on human need is always a bad idea, in my opinion. And I think certainly the refugees over, 15, 16 million people displaced by now? The country of Syria has imploded. Iraq has imploded. These are terrible events that are happening, you know, every day unfolding. And I think that I'm not sure how much the Jewish situation really sheds light on this, to be honest, because one of the things that until from basically the year 65 BCE to 1948 CE, that's a long time, one thing that didn't wasn't part of Jewish life, was sovereign territories or sovereign nations. And so I think this is quite different in some ways from both these Middle Eastern countries that were carved up at the end of World War I, a lot of them, but also the Islam grew up with a great deal of political sovereignty and self-determination. And right now, it's having to struggle, I think, with internecine quarrels among groups within Islam. I don't think there's a close parallel to the Jewish situation there. So I'm afraid I can't really be that helpful.
Well, let me just see if I can connect it in this way and relate it to something that you've taught in the past. You've taught a course on American Jew, Jewish American, the kind of ethnic case studies of the difference between our. I'm going to ask you about what's the difference between an American Jew and a Jewish American. Of course, as we know, you know, many Jews migrated, you know, to the United States, to America, and so I think that's where, you know, it's somewhat of an interesting parallel is in terms of their experience in terms of coming to this country versus, you know, the experience of other people in the Middle Eastern region coming to this country. But tell us about this course that you've taught in the past on the American Jew and the Jewish American. What do you mean by that?
Well, the title is, of course, meant to be both a little bit provocative and a little bit playful. Because, of course, you know, Jewish American is like Irish American. Is it like Irish American? Is it like Italian American?
So emphasizing the nationality, right? The nationality of being a Jew, as opposed to the religious aspect of being a Jew. An American Jew, meaning that you're an American, but you practice Judaism. Is this the main distinction? The distinction between religion and nationality?
I think that's totally fair. But the irony is that, of course, if you're just basing it on how many Jews practice Judaism, then you're going to find that less than 50% of American Jewry in any given time could be considered Judaicists. In other words, people who are actively practicing their religion. And that's the fun part of talking about American Jewry, is that for many, many Jews, by now certainly the majority, their Jewishness is mainly a product of ethnic memory or affection for parts of Jewish culture, whether it's the food or the humor or some, again, even memory not from the distant past, but just of, say, the East Coast immigrant experience, because still most American Jews are descended from that great wave from 1880 to 1920, which is true of Italian Americans and is also true of, you know, Slavic Americans. So there's that ethnic element. Then you have this strange interplay among lots of groups between forces of assimilation to be exactly like your host people, and then often in the third or fourth generation, forces of dissimilation. All of a sudden you say, hey, we don't really want to abandon absolutely everything about our heritage. And then you have curious and interesting ways of trying to reclaim a heritage that it doesn't take very long. For instance, Yiddish. I always love this example. It only takes one generation to forget a language. All the Jews who moved over from Eastern Europe, or at least most of them, were native Yiddish speakers. Already their children, who went to public schools, were native English speakers but probably still understood Yiddish. And their children, who also went to public schools and then often went to decent colleges and universities, not only did they not speak Yiddish, but they couldn't understand it either. And then their kids took Yiddish 101 or Hebrew 101 at a university like Oklahoma. So you have these interesting counterplays. I think it's scholars of American immigration. I think it's called Hansen's Law, the third generation tries to remember what the second generation tried to forget.
I love that you refer to it as ethnic memory. And we do see a lot of heritage students, I think, that come back, you know, third, maybe even fourth generation that come back and try to recapture some of those things that they lost. I mean, I know even for me, I'm a French heritage. And, you know, of course, French, you know, was in the culture and language was long gone by the time, you know, I was born. So wanting to kind of reconnect and know something about your past is really interesting, whether it's, you know, driven by one's ethnicity or religion in that case, or nationality. But it is an interesting connection that you're making.
Oh, may I just add one thing? I mean, one of the curiosities about Jewish life is that you can decide to reconnect via religion or via ethnicity and ethnic memory, that for some people have no interest whatsoever to go to a synagogue or do anything ritual, but are interested in pastrami, and others.
Is this unique, you think, to you know, the Jewish community? I mean, again, because I, you know, my family was always very French Catholic, and I could see where, you know, some of my relatives very much interested in connecting with the French, you know, side of the equation, but not necessarily with the Catholic side of the equation. And yes, Christian maybe, but not Catholic necessarily. So I'm just wondering how unique that might be to the Jewish experience.
I tend to think that all peoples are unique. I think once you learn about a particular people, you always find the story is so interesting and has so many details that I think every nation is unique.
I'm speaking with Alan Levinson, a University of Oklahoma historian who studies Judaic history. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about some of his recent work. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Let's get back to my conversation with Alan Levinson, who spent 3.5 decades studying Judaic history. When we left off, he described how third and fourth generation descendants of Jewish immigrants want to reconnect with both the religious and ethnic identity. Well, so I have to get to your most contemporary work and your upcoming book.
Sure.
Now, you've kind of moved from doing German Jewish history to studying the Bible. Interestingly, you kind of got bit by the Bible bug, I think is what you've said before. You've even taught a class on the use and abuse of the Bible since the Enlightenment. And you've got a forthcoming book on Joseph. So tell us a little bit about this transition you've made in your scholarship. Why the Bible? What is it about the Bible? And why is it that you talk about the use and abuse of the Bible in terms of helping us understand biblical history?
Sure. Well, thank you. Thank you for asking. This has been my last 10 years and probably the rest of my career. I'll work on this question. I was really struck about a decade ago, a little more, the disconnect between an academic, theoretically objective, hardcore historical critical reading of the Bible, which treats it entirely as a human document, secular document, just like every other document, and the fact that overwhelmingly and obviously most people who actually read the Bible read it from what we might say is a devotional perspective. They're looking for spiritual guidance. They're looking for values that they can use in everyday life. And it just seemed to me there was a huge gap between the Bible as it really exists in our intellectual world at one level as just another thing that is studied and studied very well, I might add, and on the other hand, what it means to most of the readers of the Bible. And so I was very interested in this. And in my previous book, The Making of the Modern Jewish Bible, I wanted to take a look at how different Jewish cultures managed to take a book from the ancient Near East, which is in fact very remote from our lives, and still make it relevant. If you look at, say, Jewish Publications Society, the oldest Jewish publisher in America from the 1880s, been in existence, almost all of their list of new scholarly works are in Bible, overwhelmingly relate to Bible in some way. So why would American Jews who are very acculturated, very modern, very secular on the whole, why do they still want to read this book so much? And that's what I tried to investigate in my last book.
And so what's the answer to that? I mean, like, you know, I know we're going to read, we're going to all read your book, but just what's the quick answer to that? Very quickly, what's the answer to that?
The quick answer I found is that the Bible is the subject, in Jewish culture at least, of so much commentary and so many different perspectives that, in fact, you can hang a meaningful identity not only on the book itself, but on the intervening 2,000 years of thought and commentary on that book, and that it's actually a surprisingly useful book.
Well, I think many people would agree with you, but like you said, perhaps for different reasons.
For different reasons. And I guess I would also say, if that comes across as a little glib, I'd say there's more common ground between a purely scholarly approach to the Bible and a more frankly devotional approach than I think sometimes is acknowledged or conceded. And I guess my argument in that book, and I continue it in my Joseph book, is that you really can be enriched in your reading of the Bible both by a traditional perspective and also from a historical critical one, that they are not contradictory. Some of the premises or axioms are contradictory, but if you put them into practice and you read a biblical story, let's say of Joseph, you'll actually find that they're very mutually enriching.
So lastly then, in the last 30 seconds that we have, Joseph, what is it that we need to know about Joseph? What are you wanting to tell us about him as the upcoming book is Portraits Through the Ages?
That every age found in Joseph, the Joseph story especially, Genesis 37 through 50, different aspects that were worth reflecting on and relating to. So some generations found the family dynamic between Joseph and his brothers the most compelling part, and other ages found the governance of Egypt and how Joseph saved the Egyptian people and the rest of humanity from starvation the most compelling parts. And then there are parts of the Joseph story that are only hinted at. For instance, his Egyptian wife, mentioned only in three verses, which generated an entire tradition of commentary and novellas and fictional literature. And Asnat, the wife of Joseph, becomes a very important character. And you can say that about the minor characters, and they all shed light on Joseph, who's the centerpiece of these chapters.
Very interesting, Alan. Thank you so much. We'll all look forward to reading the book about Joseph and your other works as well. Thank you so much for being here today on World Peace.
Thank you, Suzanne. It's been great.
You've been listening to my conversation with Alan Levinson, a professor of Judaic history at the University of Oklahoma. You can find links to excerpts of some of the books we talked about on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is part of a partnership between OU's College of International Studies and KGOU. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and we'll be back next week on New Year's Day with our year in review and global predictions for 2016. I'm Suzette Werlott.